Finance, come to order. It's 1:44, St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. We have members present, our alternate, Representative Hocker, Representative Guttenberg.
That's O. Guttenberg today.
Gutten. Vice Chair Fairclough Stoltz, Representative O. Thomas. Representative Dugan, he's Irish enough. I don't need to make him anymore. Representative Edgman, Representative Costello. That's the lower boot Irish. And Representative Newman. And I have all kinds of varying degrees of appropriate Irish jokes. I'm not going to tell any of them. Today we have. Before we start, I think, did we have something from Representative Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, I had the pleasure of trying to attend a conversation that the governor had about the Alaska Children's Trust during the noon hour, and got to deliver to House committee members the Pick, Click, and Give from their little pot of gold from that presentation, that they had some food. And the reason I was bringing it up is I just wanted to express my gratitude and those of from the legislature, I am sure, of $1.3 million of donations to Pick, Click, and Give this year. I wanted to say a personal thanks to Representative Thomas, who introduced the bill to help Alaskans convey their thanks to nonprofits who are doing good work around our state, and just let you know and share the pot of gold so that you, too, can have some sugar today. And just remind everybody, again, as a general announcement, that permanent fund deadlines for your applications, if you haven't done so already, are due on March 31st. And so if you'd like to share some of that, proceed, Pick, Click, and Give.
My colleagues with small children like this better than the other Pick and Give connotation. With that, I'd like to welcome, we're very fortunate today to override that comment I just made with his distinguished presentation, Dr. Scott Goldschmidt from the University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research.
Mr. Chairman, even your colleagues who used to have small children understand that.
My apologies, sir. It's been a long week.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Thank you for committee for the invitation and the opportunity to talk to you today about Alaska's economy. My talk today has two objectives. The first is to demonstrate the transformative impact that petroleum has had on the Alaska economy. And the second is to answer the question that we're all asking, and that is, can petroleum as an industry sustain itself, or is it on the way out? Or what can we continue to sustain the prosperity we have come to enjoy and expect for another 50 years or more? So let's start by looking back 50 years to when Alaska became a state. This is important in helping us understand how far we've come as an economy, but it's difficult for most of us to see back to Alaska in 1959, either because we were too young, or because, like me, we're more recent arrivals in the state. For about 90% of us, the Alaska economy we see today is the only one we've ever known, and we take it to be normal. In fact, it's anything but normal. But I'm getting ahead of myself on that point. Here's a list of some of the important features of the economy we had when Alaska became a state, and I won't go through them, but you can read them quickly, I'm sure. These economic characteristics were largely the result of the economic structure of the time, or the economic base, as economists would like to say, those activities that brought money into the economy from outside, or the driving forces behind the economy. And although we tend to think of the Alaska economy as being driven by natural resources, and being a foundation of the state. In fact, in 1960, we can trace 80% of all market-based jobs, directly or indirectly, to the activities of the federal government. federal government pumped money in for the military payroll, for a large construction program that supported private construction jobs and other infrastructure workers, and for the management of federal lands and other programs. Most trade and service jobs were supported by the payrolls of federal workers and their private infrastructure partners. As you can see, seafood was the largest private natural resource industry, but together with mining and timber, only accounted for about 15% of all jobs on an annual basis. Because fishing was and is seasonal, most activity was concentrated during the summer months. Tourism was in its infancy, and not much else of any consequence was going on in terms of the economy. Now let's fast forward to this decade. Use our imagination and conduct what I call a thought experiment, or a what-if experiment. What if the economy had developed as it has, except for the total absence of the petroleum industry? Well, no two people would conduct this thought experiment in exactly the same way, but I think the broad outlines of what the economy would look like in the absence of oil today are clear. The economy would be about twice the size that it was at the time we became a state, about 187,000 people versus 90,000, 187,000 jobs versus 90,000 jobs. But its characteristics would be remarkably similar to those we had at the time of statehood. Why is that? Well, it's because the economic structure of the economy would not have changed very much in that 50-year period. Private sector job growth would have come from development of our abundant natural resources. First, we would have built on existing industries like fishing, mining, and timber. We would have taken advantage of the rise of tourism. Our locational advantage would have resulted in the air cargo industry. But growth in these sectors would not have come easily, as I will explain further shortly, and the economy would still be dominated by federal spending, both military and civilian programs, accounting for about 60% of total jobs. On occasion, I have suggested the Alaska economy today without petroleum would look a lot like Maine. Dependent on natural resources, tourists, and federal spending, with a limited tax base, aging infrastructure, and an aging population. So why doesn't this thought experiment end up with a more upbeat picture of the economic history of the state? Well, it's because when you get right down to it, Alaska is an island economy. And the geographers who draw the map of the United States with Alaska hanging off the right-hand side have got it right about our island status economically, or our island structure economically. There are two characteristics that are particularly relevant to thinking about us as an island economy along with Hawaii. One, we are remote, and we have a small population. Remoteness means the cost of moving goods in from suppliers and moving goods out to markets is high compared to other places. Small size, small population, means we lack economies of scale in the production of goods for export. Together, these put us at a competitive disadvantage that's virtually impossible to overcome except for some niche markets. Think about your favorite island economy. Those niche markets tend to be seafood, tourism, and mining. Occasionally, strategic location, generally in the middle of nowhere, can also confer an advantage. For many island economies, these niche markets are not sufficiently large to provide an economic base for the entire population, which then must depend on a combination of subsistence activities and foreign or federal aid for their well-being. Well, we had the characteristics of an island economy at statehood. We have the characteristics of an island economy today, and we will in the future as well. It's our geographical destiny, if you will. But what sets us apart, what sets us apart from these other islands is that we have petroleum. Let's look at three components of petroleum's contribution to the economy, which together have doubled the size of Alaska's economy and dramatically changed our characteristics. First is the most obvious contribution through activities in the oil patch. A recent study estimated 42,000 jobs in Alaska are attributable to oil patch activities, exploration, development, production, transportation, and processing. I think this is an underestimate for a couple of reasons. Let me mention two. The number of workers producing oil is quite modest, but the petroleum payroll is much more significant than the job count would suggest. This graph shows in black the petroleum payroll compared to those of our other resource industries like fishing and tourism that are the next largest payrolls on that graph, each of which, and they each directly employ many more workers than the oil and gas industry. Jobs in petroleum are the highest paying in the state, averaging over $100,000 per job per year. In contrast, the average annual wage in the tourism sector is $29,000 a year. And since many tourism jobs only last for 4 months, the wage for each individual job is closer to $10,000. Well, high wages means lots of purchasing power cascading through the rest of the economy, supporting jobs in the trade and service sectors. Second, jobs in the petroleum industry have the characteristic of an inverted pyramid. The small number of petroleum producer jobs, BP, Conoco, Exxon, support a larger number of oil and gas support jobs in businesses like drilling companies. These in turn make purchases from and support a broader range of transportation, engineering, warehousing, utilities, financial, legal, fabrication, and camp businesses. At the very top of the pyramid are the businesses in the rest of the economy, supported by the payrolls paid in the lower parts of the pyramid. Our other economic drivers don't display this kind of job pyramid. The second component of the petroleum contribution to the economy comes from the revenues it generates for state and local governments. We're all familiar with this graph, I think. The red bars are oil revenues, historically, now running between $5 and $6 billion annually for the general fund. And the black line is the petroleum share of total general fund revenues. The direct share now is approximately 90%, 90% of general fund revenues directly from petroleum. And 90% is actually an underestimate of the importance of petroleum for state general fund revenues. Why is that? Well, if we add in revenues from activities that support petroleum production, like the corporate taxes paid by drillers, construction and engineering firms, and so on, our dependence on petroleum revenues would be closer to 95%. Another statistic I like to throw out in regard to this: since Alaska became a state, fully 98% of total resource revenues have been from petroleum.
So,
Representative Guerra.
Mr. Chair, first, an apology. I'm going to have to leave. I'm having a bad back day, so I'll watch this on gavel to gavel with my, along with my wife, probably. But can you go back to that last slide? It would be the one question I asked Mr. Goldsmith. I have no doubt that, I mean, those are the numbers we've always heard, too. But you said it's probably higher because the companies that support the industry also pay corporate taxes. Do you have any idea, though? I mean, a lot of companies in the state avoid paying corporate taxes by declaring as S corporations or anything but a C corporation, right?
Right.
Only the ones that declare as a C corporation pay the corporate tax, and so most doctors, lawyers, and other businesses pay none. Do you, so when you said lots of these other companies pay the corporate tax. Do you give us any sense of the support industry companies that pay the corporate tax as opposed to file in a different corporate format?
You know, I can't give you a specific example. You're certainly true. I looked at the share of businesses in Alaska that actually pay a corporate income tax, and it's like less than 10%.
Could you say that again?
Less than 10%.
Who pays less?
Who actually pay a corporate income tax. Okay. You're right. Most are able to avoid it, or they file under a different organizational structure, so they don't. But now the Department of Revenue doesn't split out and give any information about exactly who is paying that corporate income tax. So I'm making the assumption here that some of the corporate income tax that is collected from firms that do business with either directly or indirectly with the oil industry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Pilcher.
Is there another question?
I scanned. My neck is getting very nimble. Almost like an owl.
Okay, so.
Or exorcist, more like it. There will be no green pea soup in here, though. Go ahead.
So, how is this $5 to $6 billion a year in drilling revenue spent? What creates jobs in state government, jobs in local government, jobs in construction, jobs in other businesses doing business with state government. These jobs tend to be high-paying year-round, again, distinguishing them from fishing or tourism jobs. And this payroll also cascades to the economy for these first-sector jobs. I've estimated about 50,000 jobs in Alaska are attributable to state spending of petroleum revenues. And if we add in the permanent fund dividend, then roughly speaking, we could say about 60,000 jobs are coming from petroleum revenues directly or indirectly. The third category is what I call spin-offs from oil wealth. There are several that together account for perhaps 60,000 additional jobs, but let me mention four. A light tax burden on resource industries, public spending in support of economic development, services to senior citizens, and seasonal stability. Let me talk a little bit about each one. As this graphic shows, most petroleum revenues, and we've collected in 2010 dollars since Alaska became a state, about $157 billion worth of petroleum revenues. Most petroleum revenues have been allocated to reducing the tax burden on households and businesses, or to expanded public spending, with maybe 23-24% going into savings. The household tax burden in the absence of petroleum might be $2,300 per capita today, based on national average rates for state income tax and the state sales tax. Well, that would generate a considerable amount of revenues for the state, but those taxes would not generate enough revenue to support a level of public spending comparable to other states on a per capita basis. Resource industries would be pressured to increase their contribution to the cost of governments, since unfortunately we can't directly tax that one stool of the Alaska economy called the federal government. And if resource revenues brought us up to the national average spending level, our non-petroleum resource industries would have to increase their tax contribution by about 400% above current levels. Although an increase of that magnitude is probably unrealistic, some increase above current levels would be likely. And since higher taxes tend to drive away business, our non-petroleum natural resource industries would have suffered. It is safe to say they are in better shape today because petroleum has taken some of the tax burden off their shoulders. Well, increased public spending has been good for businesses and good for the quality of life of all Alaskans. You can probably find something among the public expenditures shown on this slide that you haven't given. If you're a business, it has reduced your costs or increased your customer base. If you're an employer, it has helped to keep your labor costs down. Furthermore, these goods and services make Alaska more attractive for senior citizens who used to leave the state upon retirement, but who now comprise the fastest growing segment of our population. They are an increasingly important driver industry for the economy. They're essentially year-round tourists who don't leave in the wintertime. The fourth important spinoff from petroleum I want to mention is seasonal stability of employment. As I indicated, when Alaska became a state, there were lots of jobs in the summer, but the economy essentially closed down in the winter. Under those circumstances, businesses supporting the resource industries or Alaska households had a hard time taking root. On the left of this figure are graphs of monthly employment levels in two Alaska boroughs dominated by seafood at the top, Bristol Bay Borough, and tourism at the bottom, the Denali Borough. You can see there are almost no employment at the start of the year. Dramatic run-up for a few summer months, and then a sharp drop back down with the approach of winter. It's no wonder that non-residents account for a large share of the jobs in these regions. And those seasonal industries are still with us today, seafood and tourism, but account for only a small share of the total employment picture, thanks to petroleum. In contrast, both oil patch and public sector jobs are year-round. In an environment of stable year-round employment, support businesses can more easily take root and prosper. Well, if we add together the oil patch jobs that I've mentioned, the petroleum revenue jobs, and the spin-off jobs, we can see from this diagram that fully half of the 375,000 jobs today can be traced directly and indirectly to petroleum. And you see on the right-hand pie, with petroleum, our economic structure is much more diverse than it otherwise would have been. And this basically reflects the notion of the three-legged stool. You can see a third federal government, a third directly related to petroleum, and a third everything else, some of which is really spin-off related jobs that are attributable to petroleum. The characteristics of the economy are much more positive than would otherwise have been the case. There's much greater depth in the economy. We have a large support sector similar to other states. It's a non-seasonal economy. It's much less transient. Federal government is still important, but not as dominant as it would otherwise have been. We have a rich infrastructure, a large tax base, and high household incomes. But in the midst of this transformation, oil production has been falling. This graph shows oil production in per capita terms to emphasize the decline rate. Because as production has been declining, population has been growing. Now, this message has been slow to get out to the general public for at least three reasons that I'm aware of. State employment over this period has continued to grow even as production has fallen. So people underestimate the importance of petroleum for the health of the economy. Second, the high price of oil has diverted attention from the production decline. And third, we have a myopic view of the future that is looking forward only a few years, at most a decade, as is the case for the official state projections of oil production and revenues, shown here actually for a 20-year period. We can fool ourselves into thinking that the future looks rosy. But independent of whether these short-term forecasts are reasonable, we look out beyond 2020. Production and revenue numbers definitely begin to tell a story of decline. So, does this production decline portend a return of Alaska to its original island economy status? Is a decline in employment and revenues, and with it the loss of these spinover benefits, inevitable? Well, there are several strategies for
before we get very far, I've been waiting for a break for Representative Dugan's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott, back. One more.
No, the next one. Right where you were. That's you. Thank you. So what is the purple? At least it's purple here. Represent?
Oh, I'm sorry. The purple represents Cook Inlet production.
Ah, thank you.
The gray is North Slope production.
North Slope. Okay, thanks.
And it's on a per capita basis. So at the peak, we're looking at 4 barrels per capita per day. We're down right about 1 barrel per day now. So.
Okay, thank you.
Three fourths.
Any other questions at this break juncture? Okay, Mr. Goldsmith.
There are a number of strategies for moving forward that have commonly been suggested and proposed to address this challenge. I would argue that all of the ones I'm going to talk about five, have some merit, but none carry sufficient power in and of themselves to offset declining petroleum. And even taken together, they're not strong enough. Let me quickly review what they are. The first strategy is commercialization of gas. Let me just say that if a gas line were built, it would generate jobs in the oil patch, but its revenues would not be sufficient to replace those from oil. Why is that? And that is a question that's answered by this figure. It's because the tax base for gas is much smaller than the tax base for oil on a BTU basis. Here the two are compared on an equal energy or BTU basis. You can see the bottom is gas, and the top bar is oil in an equivalent measure, an equivalent BTU measure. So the gas is a million BTUs, and the oil is a million BTUs. Million BTUs of oil, when I put together this graph a couple of weeks ago, was worth about $14 on the market. It's worth a lot more today. Okay. The market value of a million BTUs of gas, however, is when I put this together, I was being optimistic, $6. Now it's under $4. Okay. So this graph is not totally current, but it will give you the notion that I'm trying to get across, and that is, first of all, that the energy value in oil is worth a lot more than gas, and then secondly, we have to ask the question, well, how much does it cost to get this energy to market? Well, to get a million BTUs of oil to market through taps costs about $1. To get a million BTUs of gas to market through a $30 or $40 billion gas pipeline will cost about $4. So when you net back to the wellhead, which is where the tax value is determined and the royalty value, you can see that there's quite a bit of difference between the value of oil and the value of gas. So we can't expect, even if a gas line comes to fruition in the next 10 or 15 years, that the revenues from gas will be able to offset declining revenues from oil. The second strategy that one hears quite often is that our non-petroleum natural resources will grow to fill any void created by declining petroleum. We take the growth in jobs in what I call the big three, seafood, tourism, and mining, over the last 20 years and assume the same growth during the next 20, then this is what we get, very modest direct employment growth, mostly in tourism. Mining, 1,000 jobs. Tourism, 10,000 jobs. And seafood, no 1,000 jobs. Now, this is not a prediction, but it's rather just an exercise to provide a sense of scale with regard to these other natural resource industries. And these other drivers clearly don't pack the revenue punch that oil has. Here we see how much the state would need to collect per unit of output in order to replace $3 billion of petroleum revenues annually from each of these other resource industries. For example, we would need to shake down each tourist to the tune of $2,000.
And Mr. Goldschmidt, is that in taxes or is
in
that
taxes.
In taxes? I just want to differentiate, not just money spent.
Taxes and fees.
Okay, they'd have to spend a pretty
soon. Shake it out of them somehow.
You could do that, I guess, one time.
That's more than each tourist currently spends to visit while visiting the state. For salmon, it would be $20 a salmon.
That'd be taxes on salmon, not getting $20 a salmon.
Be the tax per salmon. For the mining industry, it would be $4,000 per ounce of gold.
And what is gold an ounce of? About $1,400?
Gold is currently, yeah.
So that'd be $4,000 taxes on what something that's now selling for $1,400?
That's right.
I just want to, these are baffling numbers. They're baffling. They're sobering.
They're sobering. And keep in mind that this is if we try to get that entire $3 billion all from the tourists, or we try to get it all from the salmon. Obviously, if we split it up, we could divide it by three for each of the industries.
I want to hear a real staggering number. How much would we have to charge for a pack of cigarettes? I don't smoke, but I'm just curious.
I don't smoke anymore. I think it would be close to $1,000.
That might be a deterrent, I guess. $1,000, and that's in the taxes, not the cost. And that's the local governments follow suit. They'd find their $1,000 too.
That's right. We find a lot of people flying to Seattle this month.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott, I'm sorry, I lost a stitch there. So in each of these cases, we would have to do that to generate the same amount of money that oil generates?
No. I've arbitrarily, for this diagram, for this exercise, said, let's say we have to get $3 billion a year.
Okay, just $3 billion flat.
Just $3 billion from one of these non-petroleum natural resources.
And pay for K-12 and Hess.
Right.
Yeah. If we got it all from the tourism industry, we would have to impose a tax on each tourist about $2,000 a head.
And if we, excuse me, Mr. Chairman,
and if
we did it from a mix of these sources, it would depend on how you mixed them, what
right.
It would come out. Okay.
Yeah, then it would be less.
Yeah, thank you.
I just want to make sure everybody understands that these are just hypothetical speculatives because people get scared enough by some of the little things we suggest around here.
It's not my proposal.
I don't think you can be too cautious in clarifying this in this environment.
Although at the rate that salmon actually costs me when I go fishing, Mr. Chairman, this might be a deal.
Well, I'm sure we
have. Clearly.
I didn't mean to digress. These are sobering numbers.
Mm-hmm. Alaskans have long been lured into the pursuit of economic development strategies, primarily value-added and economic diversification, usually supported by outside experts. Examples include fish processing plants, the Alpetco petrochemical plant, aluminum reduction plants, server farms, dairy farming, you name your favorite. These have generally not worked for a variety of reasons I won't discuss today, but past experience and economic realities will not deter economic boosters. There's always a compelling urge to do something, and they shouldn't. We should be looking for every economic advantage, but we should also be extremely cautious about spending state revenues on projects that promise to replace petroleum. A quick Google search on the term Alaska Economic Development Strategic Plans turned up 374,000 results, one for every two Alaskans. A lot of economic development strategizing in Alaska only creates jobs for those doing the strategizing, for only as long as they're doing it. I'm not aware of any that has produced any revenues for the state general fund. Fourth strategy moving forward is the idea to emulate the Norwegian economy. If we invest in infrastructure to reduce the price of energy and transportation, this will open a cornucopia of profitable investment opportunities for development of our non-petroleum resource industries. It sounds seductively attractive, but the danger is that we end up with an empty cornucopia with the investment spent on a temporary feast of construction spending with no long-term return, either in the form of jobs or revenues to the state. And one last strategy that's sort of new on the horizon is to develop our abundant renewable energy resources. This would certainly be good for the environment and help stabilize prices for and bring down prices for consumers and businesses. It could temporarily generate economic opportunities for Alaskans. But shifting to renewables will not bring new money into the state to replace the sales of petroleum, because we're not selling those renewables to anybody outside of Alaska. For this reason, it's not an economic driver and will not contribute to sustained employment opportunities or to revenues to replace petroleum. So, if these are our strategies and they're not up to the task, and petroleum production continues to decline, based on our past experience over the last 30 years, there are three possible futures for the state. First one is, we are the chosen ones. Those who think good luck will keep the good times coming can point to a number of times in the past when luck did save the day for Alaska. Prudhoe Bay oil discovery, high oil prices spared us from most of the effects of the current national recession. So it's possible to be optimistic and believe that the state's luck will hold, with rising oil prices, driving future developments, keeping the economy healthy, and the state treasury full. Second future scenario, the big crash, or I can handle the hangover because the party was so awesome. Alaskans who know the state's history as a boom and bust economy, especially the economic turmoil Alaska went through when oil prices crashed in the mid-1980s, they have reason to believe it could happen again. World oil markets are nothing if not volatile, so it's possible to be pessimistic and think plummeting oil prices could dry up investment in petroleum development and blindside Alaska's economy again. Third, the slow squeeze, or up a lazy river. The economy enjoyed moderate, steady growth in the 1990s, but at the same time, flat oil prices and falling oil production were eating away at the state's oil revenues. The state balanced the budget during most of the 1990s by drawing on the Constitutional Budget Reserve, and it hadn't been for that rainy day account, the need for dramatic budget cuts and tax increases would have put the brakes on the economy. So it's not unreasonable to think that if future oil prices flatten and there was little new exploration development, both state spending and the economy could dwindle. But there's at least one other possibility for a future scenario. We still are resource rich in petroleum. The production decline figures we always see are based on production only on state lands in Cook Inlet on the North Slope between the Colville and the Canning Rivers. Production from those lands has been 16 billion barrels, approximately, and there's forecasted by Department of Revenue to be 4.5 billion barrels remaining in known and unknown fields. So that sounds pessimistic. On the other hand, the total market value of the 16 billion we have produced was about $500 billion in 2010 dollars, because the average price of that production was about between $25 and $30 a barrel in today's prices. While the market value for the remaining oil may be in the neighborhood of $450 billion, this is assuming a $100 price for a barrel of oil. So in terms of value, we may be only halfway through the inventory on the North Slope central part of the North Slope.
Here.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, sir. I just think it. You, two slides I'd like to put in juxtaposition here in that last reference. Definitely heard your counsel that gas is not going to replace oil in our the level of our dependency on it. But you also had the earlier slide where you talked about gas today being market value some $4. The cost of getting that gas to even close to market was $4. So I suppose I can have a takeaway that there's not much margin left in gas at that point.
At the moment.
And, so, and so when we're talking here, you know, gas having that potential huge dollar value to us, not a fair statement that we've got a lot of, we need to see a fairly substantial shift in world commodities market prices in order to have a significant increase in income from gas.
I guess the way I interpret this, it looks at technically recoverable barrels of oil and TCFs of gas, and the action in the short run is going to be in oil. If we're looking forward a generation or two generations, then the gas resources, potential gas resources that we have are certainly impressive.
Thank you, Professor. That was much better said than I could ever possibly get to.
Nonsense.
I'm just trying to think, how do we get that little monopoly man to keep passing go and collecting instead of going back three spaces or going directly to jail, just metaphorically?
Yeah, I'm not sure that was
right. I'm just trying to be consistent with the board game.
Yeah. Okay, the $4.5 billion estimate for oil for Colville Canning is what's called conventional oil. And then in addition to that, there's perhaps 34, 35 billion barrels of technically recoverable oil estimated to be on federal lands, ANWR, OCS, and NPRA. In addition to that, there are what are known as unconventional reserves, which I haven't included on here. Everybody's heard now about heavy and viscous oil and the potential large reserves associated with that that type of oil, as well as more recently we're hearing rumblings about shale oil. So the point of this is that there is a lot of petroleum potential, a potentially developable petroleum still on the North Slope. And there's lots of gas as well. But before we get too excited, we need to remember that getting Alaska oil and gas to market is very expensive. Only if the market price can support the high cost will any of these potential resources be produced. And what factors contribute to cost, particularly over and above the high costs already experienced in production from North Slope fields? Well, size. New conventional production on state lands will be from smaller fields lacking the economies of scale of Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, and Alpine. Distance. You can see where TAPS is on this map. New production from federal lands in particular will be long distances from TAPS, OCS, offshore, even further. And that adds to the cost of getting product to market. And last but not least, physics. Heavy and viscous oil will be technically challenging to produce, and once produced will have a somewhat lower value. It will also be harder to push through the pipeline, I might add. Shale oil is too new to even speculate about. Squeezing more oil out of our legacy fields will involve expensive new technologies.
I'd like to just final ask, tomorrow we have Admiral Barrett. Let's try to remind him and answer the question about the challenges of moving smaller quantities of these different grades of oil. That those are my attentive committee members. Excuse for the interruption.
Some analysts think the cost will be too high to justify further production, but the opportunity for much more production is clearly available to us. And what could production of some of this oil and gas mean for jobs, income, and public revenues in the future? Well, historically, production per employee has fallen. It's a large graph here. So total employment has actually grown over time. That's the small graphic you see there. And this is production in the oil patch. Of course, this is both bad news and good news. The bad news is that the cost of getting each barrel out of the ground in terms of worker time has increased, a reflection of the fact that costs are increasing. But the good news is that production has although production has declined, employment has held up quite well. And just as one indicator of potential, looking forward, it's possible the development of some of the additional resources could add significantly to employment. This petroleum-related jobs projection is from a recent study by ICER of the potential impacts of OCS development on state employment. And it shows that the employment generated if OCS development went forward expeditiously, could have a similar impact on total employment as Prudhoe Bay development and span more than a generation. You probably can't see the time period indicated here, but it goes from 2008 to 2050. So we're talking about a generation or more in the future. So, $64 question, how do we get those petroleum jobs? They're certainly not guaranteed by any means. This is a two-pronged approach. It's not rocket science, what we need to do. We need to work to open our federal lands to responsible development, OCS, ANWR, NPRA. I think we need to make the national security case better and the economic health of the nation case better. That is, opening ANWR would have benefits in both of these areas. Now, it's interesting. People make the argument, well, that oil wouldn't be available for 10 years. They made that argument 10 years ago. What's wrong with this picture? The second thing we need to do, obviously, is adopt a rational and positive attitude with the industry to foster continued developments on state lands. And I won't talk any more about that, I'm sure.
Yes, and then we'll get a break for Representative Harker's question.
If you've heard more than an earful of that in the last several days or weeks. Yes.
Well, no, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor, could you go back one slide? And I apologize for making notes on your previous slide there at the time. It just strikes me in juxtaposition to your previous slide where the recent, I'm trying to figure out what that date is back there, but what is it in the past? Essentially 20 years we've gone on a daily production per worker from 250 barrels down to about 50 barrels, it looks like. It's tells me something about, you know, the efficiency, the additional costs of operating, all that good stuff. Then I look at this next chart of yours. When we go from relatively now at that, which is off the very far left side of that chart, up, when, you know, in the hypothetical, we're talking hypothetical here, 50 years is a long time out there, but how does the oil and gas economy sustain that degree of inefficiency when we're talking about a, you know, an increase to where the number of, if I'm reading this right, that employment number on the left, you have to, you're looking at 40,000 jobs, say, in, you know, oil field support.
This,
what does that do to that cost per barrel number?
Two things. First, to recognize this is just an overlay of the additional jobs that would be associated with strong oil and gas development over the next 40 years in both the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea. The second thing is that if, I didn't explain it, but if you look at what the four bars represent, it's the bottom, is that sort of purplish, bluish area that is the oil field employment.
So that's the number that correlates to the previous slide.
That's correct. And everything on top of that is either indirect jobs generated elsewhere in the economy, or jobs generated by the revenues from OCS activity. And I'll talk about those revenues in a minute. They're not very large, but they are insignificant.
Take away from this then, and I'm just trying to kind of guesstimate, looking at the graphic presentation here, from 2012 out there to, you know, you're showing, gosh, well, let's realistically here, 2020. I mean, that's 8 years from now. That's short, truly a flash of time when it comes to government process. That looks like, I mean, that number's got to be increasing from, I mean, what is it down there in 2012 2012, however many few that is, up to almost 10,000. And now, if you were to overlay that statistic with your previous chart, what do we get for a required, you know, that oil production per worker? What's it going to be in 2020 by that analysis?
Well, I can't tell you for sure what it would be, but clearly the prospects of the OCS have got to be large, and they've got to be very profitable, potentially profitable, before the oil industry is going to invest in producing them. And what that says to me is that the productivity per worker in terms of oil produced on the big fields that would be produced in the OCS is going to be larger than what we're looking at today from production on state lands. I don't know whether – I doubt it would go up as high as Prudhoe Bay productivity was at the beginning of its life, but it would certainly go up.
Okay, well, I think I've got my takeaway that this chart presumes the hypothetical that we are bringing on very significant volumes of production from these other, at the moment, undeveloped and even prohibited resources.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And I think the other thing to point out is, and I mentioned that the number of jobs generated by activity in the oil patch currently is around 60,000. If you look at this graph, maybe a little hard to see the numbers, but at the peak with this graph, you're looking at about 50,000 jobs. So if we were to be able to move forward with OCS development expeditiously, and there were discoveries that were economically producible, this is sort of a picture of what the upside potential is. Now, I would have to add a caveat that this analysis was started about two and a half years ago, and you know, the whole schedule for OCS has already slipped 2.5 years in the 2.5 years since we did this analysis. But the picture is the same.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, to look at the top of that, which is in 28 or whatever it is, 32, somewhere in there, those are the total jobs generated by oil production. That is to say, this I'm having a problem because this chart seems to be saying that it's 50,000 direct employment jobs for petroleum. And I don't think that's what you're saying, right?
No. As I said, you know, there are four separate bars there. The bottom bar, the one that's sort of purplish gray.
Gotcha.
Those are the jobs in the oil patch. And those are jobs that are directly related to the production or the exploration, development, production, and transportation of oil. And in this analysis, it was done a couple of years ago. The price of gas was higher and was being projected to increase. And so there's gas production.
So, if I might, Mr. Chairman, so the bulk of those jobs on this chart are in support.
They're in various support functions, yeah. And they, so that would include the drillers, it would include the truckers, it would include the engineering firms, blah, 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 but then it would also include the jobs in Anchorage that are generated because these workers are going to live in urban Alaska and going to buy houses and spend money in Anchorage, et cetera.
So it would include, like, the baristas and those kind of folks as well? Okay.
Yeah, all the baristas are in there.
Thanks.
All
10,000. Thank you.
We had to revise our models. Okay, so the challenge is how to get those petroleum jobs, and you're facing that directly right now. The question that remains is, can development of these resources generate the public revenues we've grown accustomed to? And the short answer is no. This table, which I won't go into in any detail, but it does show the fiscal terms, state fiscal terms associated with production from lands under different ownership. And the only important thing to well, there's nothing important really to say about this. It's just too complicated. But if we run a hypothetical oil field through that matrix to see what oil revenues would be generated from production under various scenarios, under various conditions, then you come up with this other matrix, which is also very complicated, and I'm not going to walk through. But if you compare the left-hand column with the right-hand column, it's pretty dramatic. If we run a hypothetical oil field, and I think it's a, I can't remember the size or the actual terms, but if we run that oil field on the North Slope on state lands, potential revenues to the state would be annually $838 million. On the other hand, if that oil field were offshore in federal lands more than 6 miles from land, the total direct revenues to the state would be zero. Now, that's not to say that the state would not enjoy some revenues from that economic activity, but you would have to capture revenues from that activity offshore.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor Goldsmith, have you done any research on the migration since the new tax was adopted on whether there is increased exploration on state property versus federal property? Have you done any research? I've asked our own Department of Natural Resources and had a fairly murky answer.
I have not done any research myself, and I don't even know if gas consultant. I suppose the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission data allows you to identify.
So I'll ask that question of them, Mr. Chairman.
Offshore,
federal property versus state property is where I was going.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I was asking that question is it appeared to me after we adopted ACEs that there was a migration from development on state land over to federal land to avoid the taxes that we're in ACEs, which is why I'm interested in looking at and analyzing the ACE structure now.
So if the future is optimistically more oil production and more oil-related employment, but less petroleum revenues, how should we deal with the fact that we probably want to maintain public spending from petroleum revenues as long as possible and to sustain the jobs that are created by the spending? Well, I argue that we need to change the way we think about petroleum revenues. We cannot continue to mindlessly collect the revenues, pat ourselves on the back when we put a few dollars away in a savings account, spend a few dollars when we have a short-term surplus, and just hope for the best. We need to inventory our petroleum wealth and manage it like an asset. My estimate of our wealth is on this picture. I put it at $126 billion, consisting of $45 billion of financial assets derived from past revenues and $81 billion in likely tax and royalty revenues from petroleum still in the ground yet to be produced. And this is the present value of those future revenues. I won't go into detail of how I came up with those numbers, but my question is, how should we manage this wealth? We always say the natural resources belong to all Alaskans. If we really believe that, then every Alaskan should have an equal right to a share of this net worth. Let's assume we care about all future generations of Alaskans. The population continues to grow at 1% a year, sustained by the petroleum industry, and that future generations of Alaskans will be neither richer nor poorer than we are today. Well, then we can calculate the maximum amount that we can spend from our wealth this year on behalf of each Alaskan and still maintain the value of our wealth for future generations. I calculated it to be $7,200. If we constrain the distribution to that amount, we can give each Alaskan that same amount adjusted for inflation next year and the next year and so on for as long as necessary until some other economic driver can replace petroleum jobs and revenues. Since there are about 700,000 Alaskans, that means we can spend $500 billion this year and preserve our net worth for future generations. Any additional spending would need to come from sources other than our petroleum wealth. The flip side of sustainable spending is savings. If spending is preserving our net worth, and whatever petroleum revenues are not spent must go into income-generating investments. A shift to net asset fiscal management would require a complete change in the way we think about budgeting, away from our current focus on current petroleum revenues. But it has several obvious advantages. We're able to avoid a crash, which otherwise seems inevitable at some point. We don't pass a fiscal burden on to the next generation, because each generation gets an equal share of our wealth. Those who benefit from public expenditures pay for those public expenditures. We show the world that we can responsibly manage our wealth, and we decouple our fiscal policy and wealth management from one another. It takes the pressure off oil and other industries to be constantly providing revenues to fund the budget for the current year. Well, this is how a wealth management plan would look over time. From the date of discovery, or the date of first production from the North Slope in 1978, when all of our wealth was in the ground, until the date when all of our, the oil on the North Slope has been produced, which I assume to be 2050. With this strategy, the net asset value of our combined assets would grow over time at 1% in real terms with population. And the arrow shows approximately where we are today with our wealth split between oil in the ground, still in the ground, and money in the bank. Well, in closing, my answer to the question of whether our petroleum economy is sustainable is a rousing maybe. There's no guarantee that petroleum can sustain our economy for another 50 years. It's going to require luck. But petroleum offers the best chance for continued prosperity. In order to maximize the chance of that happening, we need to wake up and we need to be proactive. If we don't, we'll be like the frog who doesn't realize she is slowly cooking in the pot of boiling water. We've, in the past, been both smart and lucky. But looking forward, we need to be smarter because we cannot count on good luck forever. We need to take to heart those words of Yogi Berra. The future ain't what it used to be. With that, I'll close, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott, back in what is my annual share, and it says $7,200. Is that all in? I mean, is the permanent fund in there? So is this, how should I put this? Is the $7,200 what's currently spent now?
It's a combination of spending today out of our financial assets, and that would primarily be because we're in a surplus environment, that would be out of the permanent fund, the dividend. And spending out of the petroleum revenues currently collected. And we don't spend all of the petroleum revenues that we currently collect because we're in a surplus environment. It's just that share that we do spend to fund the general fund.
Thanks. If I could, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if, for instance, I don't know why I even have this scenario in my head, but suppose we spent more money than we brought in this year. Would that additional spending be encompassed in this $7,200 total?
In order to maintain the value of our assets, yes, it would need to be. Any draw that we took out of the CBR, any draw that we took out of general fund or what was in the general fund carried over from prior years, yes. So in a deficit year, we want to look at a combination of petroleum revenues currently into the general fund, draws from the CBR and the general fund to fund the general fund, and the permanent fund dividend.
And those are data categories. Are data. Thank you very much.
That's what we're we'd be spending out of our petroleum.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott, does the 7,200, I understand the total state spending concept, does that take into account the PERS, TERS liability?
It doesn't take account specifically of how the money would be spent. But the since the PERS, TERS liability is largely coming out of the general fund, If because of the PERS, TERS liability, the spending out of the general fund was such that it would put you over the $7,200 limit, then if you want to maintain the value of your assets, you've got to find the money to pay for that somewhere else.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You guys are a lot bigger in person than
hey, wait a minute.
And I was disappointed I couldn't see the PowerPoint from the thing that we have set up. But and maybe you answered this. Let's say everything went the worst way possible in terms of oil production. And we get to the point where we're at a point where the pipeline has shut down. And we have today's budget. Which was, what, roughly $8.9 billion of non-federal money, I think. Something close to that is what the operating budget was. Have you done a calculation of, God forbid, what an income tax would have to be to replace oil revenue? I keep getting my decimals mixed up, and I can't tell. I think it's more. I think it's not 1,000, but closer to 10,000. But 16.
And just for clarification, is that for taxpayers or by capita?
Right.
Why one, Mr.
Capital Workers?
Yeah, working man.
Well, it's Mr. Goldsmith. Is there, which one is it?
Well, first of all, the loss of that $8 billion for the economy would. Result in a significant part of the population leaving the state. So the way I think about this thought experiment is, well, what would the size of, first of all, what would the size of the economy look like in the absence of that stimulus? And then work back from that to what would an income tax and a sales tax on those residents who remained have to be in order to pay for the same size of government for the smaller population we have. Now, the one graph, and I don't know the answer to that, but the one graph I showed was what the burden on household, on individuals might be if we imposed an income tax and a sales tax, because most states have both a state income tax and a state sales tax, at national average rates. The national average rates, talking about you and I each paying about $2,300 per capita for a family of four, you multiply that by four. Well, that would get you, given today's population, if I'm doing the numbers right, about $1.7 billion total. So to get $8 billion, you'd have to multiply that by four or five. So we're talking about a big hit.
I'm going to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And then it would be hard to sort of radically change the way the state does business very quickly, but let's say we get lucky with $100 barrel oil, $1 a barrel oil like we've seen lately, and we're able to put money away, do you, I mean, I've seen your sort of endowment recommendations. That's going to be hard, but short of doing an endowment, will we get anywhere saving $2 billion a year for 5-10 years if we get lucky with high oil prices?
We are lucky now, I would say. We're lucky for probably the fourth time in our oil history. And I think that we should take advantage of that luck by putting as much as possible away for an uncertain future.
Can we put enough in a state 401k where we can all, this is kind of assuming a retirement mode when we stop working, i.e. the i.e. oil stops working, do we have enough time to put, I'm just using 401k because that's sort of what we're looking at. Is that possible in the short time span we have and some of the projections?
Well,
with the continuing spending and the increases at the accompanying them.
I would say it is possible if we act reasonably, if we act with forward thinking, because we are blessed right now with very high oil prices that we 5 years ago we didn't think were going to be possible, and that's giving us surpluses, and particularly if the Department of Revenue is correct in its oil projections, we're looking at very high oil revenues through at least the next 10 years.
And some might call it planning a safe landing, perhaps?
Maybe so. Maybe we have another opportunity for the safe landing that we missed last time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I forget who it is, but I think somebody at this table has got a proposal to put another $10 billion in the permanent fund.
How much are we spending in the permanent fund for state operations now?
An increasing amount, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Representative Costello.
Thank you, through the chair, Dr. Goldsmith. I've been reading your materials and certainly find all of your work interesting and valuable for those of us who are following the role of oil in the state's economy. My question is, the committee is looking at a bill that it doesn't change the base tax rate of our oil taxes. What it does is changes how we address the progressivity, how we apply the progressivity to our tax structure right now, in addition to some 40% tax credit on infield work. But my question is, the premise behind the bill, do you agree with it? Do you agree that currently ACES is not, and the progressivity is discouraging investment in our state?
Well, as an economist, I have to say that incentives matter. That's one of the first things we learn in Economics 101. And on that basis, I would have to say that if the tax regime is made more attractive to the industry, it will attract more activity. In this case, it's extremely difficult to say how much or when it will happen or how it will happen, but I'm pretty confident that that is the case. And I think the other thing that's important is that ACES was developed in a much lower price environment, and we're moving into uncharted territory in terms of price, and it may be with us now forever. That alone, I think, is an important reason to rethink where we are in terms of our oil tax policy, particularly with regard to other, in relation to other places. But not only in relation to other places, in relation to what we could be.
And a follow-up for the chair. We think a lot in terms of what's economic and also what's competitive. So we've looked at charts that say if House Bill 110 and the adjustment to the progressivity and how we apply it is, achieved through this legislation, that Alaska then moves from having, you know, one of the highest marginal tax rates, one of the higher effective tax rates, and it shifts us a little bit to the left so that we're, do you think that shift will make us more competitive, or do you think that we really want to be actually going further left and being in the middle of the pack when it comes in terms of the overall world markets?
I haven't studied it so closely to be able to form an opinion on how far to the left we should shift. It would be really beneficial if, as a state, we had a better understanding of what the options, what the opportunities were for new oil developments on the North Slope in all dimensions, and what the cost structures were with those projects. It would put us in a much stronger position as an owner state to be able to answer your question, partly, I think, because unlike North Dakota, where you can drive a truck with a rig behind it anywhere in the state and drill a well in a matter of a few days, and there are, I don't know how many rigs operating now, but there's a lot going on, and it's in little bits and pieces, so you can statistically get a sense of what happens when you change the tax rates there. Here, things are a lot lumpier. You know, we don't have a lot of projects. We have a limited number of projects, and don't know how far you have to move the tax structure to kick one from being unprofitable to being profitable. That's the challenge, I think. And we don't have any answer to that.
Thank you.
Representative Thomas,
the next. Okay, thank you. Only because I'm getting educated in this room and things start coming on. And you're an economist now. And you said we need to spur development. So we give tax credits to new oil. Would we tax the new oil at a different rate versus the old? I mean, you already got old oil coming in and they're paying that rate. And our job, and everybody we've heard in the email, we need new jobs. So we need to incentivize new wells and new oil, not the old oil, unless I'm thinking of hearing people wrong. But
sorry, so
the question is, do you change the tax rate on old oil? Because what we're really looking for here, from what I'm hearing, is more jobs, new wells, and new development. You got, they call it the legacy wells and fields. They're not putting any new wells in there because they don't have to. They just keep pumping. So would you tax the old wells, the legacy wells, at an existing rate? That wouldn't. I mean, why would you lower it in this body right now when it's an existing well versus we're looking for new wells and new jobs?
Well, I think that ACE has tried to get at the problem that the state faces, which is that there's some very productive fields that are very profitable and can bear a higher tax rate, but when you're looking forward at new developments, they can't support as high a tax rate. So how do you balance the two? Well, you can't balance the two with a single tax rate. So ACE is trying to deal with a high tax rate but offering credits, and I think that was an interesting attempt, but I don't think it's been entirely successful. And I guess there's really no way to get both. You have to compromise. You have to compromise between current revenues, taxing a high rate, and long-term expectation of long-term revenues taxing a slightly lower rate. That's the trick, and it's not an easy game. For
sure. Well, you're our first economist. He's going to have to be leading us here. No. No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hedgman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the presentation. I saw the earlier one at the Baranoff a couple weeks ago, and definitely a sobering message. And certainly, you know, the big takeaway is that we're in a tough situation, but as a legislator representing the rural district, I have to keep an eye on the cost side as well. But how long would it take you to put together sort of a composite economic picture if you used present value calculations, inflation adjustments, population trends, recognizing that there's a handful of drivers that sort of control a lot of the state spending, but how long would it take you to put that kind of a research effort together and bring it to a conclusion?
I'm not quite understanding what it is that the...
I'm sorry. I meant to say that, that through the chair, that assuming that we did do what I think we're ultimately going to have to do, but let's say that we did reduce oil taxes and it created a $1 billion or maybe a $2 billion shortfall in terms of revenue, but using that as a backdrop, how long would it take you to put a composite sort of picture together that would help us better understand the timeline, having to dig into savings and looking at the programs that are formula-driven that we have to support and this, that, and the other, but to put that sort of composite economic picture together to help us better understand the other side?
Well, I don't think it would take very long. You already have a tool available to you to start to do that, and that's the OMB 10-year projection, which takes the Department of Revenue 10-year forecast of revenues and overlays on that a forecast of general fund spending. And I think that's a very useful tool that you can use to look at different scenarios. And I've argued that tool should really be pushed out beyond 10 years, because under current assumptions, for the first 10 years, things look pretty good. You know, particularly if you make the assumption that the general fund spending is going to grow at like 3% a year, which you know, everybody has their own opinion about that one. But if you do make that assumption, then with Department of Revenue's revenue forecast, you're looking at surpluses running out almost for the next 10 years, I think, in the most recent one. But if you push that another 10 years, then things look quite a bit different. And if you start playing around with changing the revenue regime, as well as changing the expenditure growth rate, then you get a fuller, richer picture of where the vulnerability is. So, you know, I'm happy to do that. I mean, it's a very simple model. I've got a copy of it myself, but you know, you can certainly ask OMB to do that as well.
Through the chair, I appreciate the picture that you're laying out here, because it's sobering, but it's also very true. But you know, I've asked this of the administration as well, but I want to see the composite of the other side too. What you know, we got X amount in savings that are liquid assets that we could tap into if we had to, without going into permanent fund earnings, without having to increase taxes. But it would be interesting to be able to look out in the future and to build a model that would help us better understand what the implications are going to be in the short term while we wait for further development, knowing that we've got X amount of drivers in the budget and that there are certain population trends and other inflation factors and, you know, this, that, and the other.
Thank you.
Mr. Goldsmith, you mentioned something about that ACES was a high tax rate, and I just want to go back. When we debated ACES, there was a discussion about having a lower tax rate on less profitable fields and a higher tax rate on more profitable, like the legacy fields. And the way it was written, at least the way it was explained to us, by having a 25% tax rate and then progressivity not kicking in until each field had $30 worth of profit, you actually did that. You had a different tax rate on marginal fields than you did on highly productive fields. So, in your mind, does that at least help some?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I think you're probably right about that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. ACES has a number of interesting features.
Thank you.
Representative Hawker, counterpoint.
No, not a counterpoint. It was a perfect segue, because That, yes, the second time I've heard you in this presentation use the word interesting to describe the whole ACES legislation. Earlier you'd said it was an interesting attempt and it wasn't altogether successful, and just now you said, you know, ACES was interesting. I'm just wondering, you know, and I guess I put that in the classic, it's the cryptically professorial nature of your presentation. Is there, what's underlying your, characterization of ACES as interesting, which to me implies there's something really to ponder here that's in the back of your mind? And I'll be honest, I don't have a clue what your answer to this is going to be. I'm really curious.
Interesting. I don't either. But I think one of the really interesting things is the way it attempts to deal with this challenge, which is how do we tax the legacy fields at a high rate and tax new development at a lower rate, given that the new fields can only handle a lower rate of taxation. And just the way that they attempted to, the ACES attempts to address that question. I mean, it's sort of an economic challenge. It's a game. That's why it's interesting.
If I might, just, again, that's, I'm glad you looped back to that again, because that point, and that was that it attempts to tax legacy fields at a higher rate and newer fields at a lower rate. Yeah, that is what I heard you say just there.
That would be my characterization. I don't claim to be the expert on ACES. I wasn't following the debate very closely when it was.
And this is economic philosophy with the economics professor, so that's really where I'm enjoying this. But I think there's a reality point here that that it may be inconsistent with that analysis or that conclusion. And that, well, you know, the old saw goes that the best place to find oil is in an oil field. The cost of that later development in those mature years of a legacy province for the unit basis, I'm oversimplifying, but for the per barrel basis, the cost of that additional production is much higher. It's much less profit margins than when you fire up that brand new field for the first time and the wells are pumping like crazy. You've got a minimal investment in infrastructure. In fact, I think it'd be very much illustrated by your table that showed the productivity per worker. I mean, it costs a lot of money to maintain an aging field, and so again, why would we want then to tax an already stressed field more than we would want to tax a field that is young and vigorous? You know, it's kind of like, we're out there running an army. Old guys like you and me sit in the back room and direct the young guys with strong backs out to carry the load.
Well, certainly a field like Prudhoe or Kuparuk, if we squeeze another 1%, production out of either of those fields, it would be equivalent to, developing a new satellite or even finding a new field. And so those are certainly things that we want to do. And also, if we can apply new technology to those existing fields, we want to do that as well. And both of those things are going to be much higher marginal cost than and comparable marginal cost, probably, or comparable cost to developing new fields. So certainly, for that part of production from legacy fields, we would want to have our tax structure such that it incentivizes that. But I guess. To follow up on the interesting question would be that if you've got a existing production from a legacy field at $80 a day per barrel, and all of a sudden it goes to $120 per barrel a day, then there's some profit there that's not reflected by an increase in cost. And the trick is to try to while you're interested in current revenues and you don't care about the long-term health of the industry, the trick is to skim off as much of the profit as you can, the excess profit that you can. And on some activities, there's going to be more excess profit than on others. And if you had perfect knowledge, perfect information, you could set your tax rates so that you could do that.
I talked around a number of things, but that last point I think brought it to a point with me, and that is this issue of do we skim as much profit as we can, the state, can we skim as much take as we can now in our short-term interests, or is it wiser for us to moderate the short-term skim for a long-term sustained skim? Is that an economic term?
My feeling is that we should not try to maximize the skim, because one of the things we tend to or overlook when we take that approach is the risk associated with activities in the oil patch. The rate of return has to be higher to compensate for the extreme risks associated with investing huge amounts of capital in activities that may or may not pay off in the short run or even in the long run. Aside from the issue of, does our tax rate appear to be competitive with other locations?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have to confess, I was noting the word interesting. I was thinking of that sci-fi episodic that ran from 66 to 69 every time the Enterprise was on a death spiral. Mr. Spock always calmly said, fascinating. We're sort of on some spirals of note here as well, but that was just, if you have too much time sitting and mostly watching. Professor Goldschmidt. Are we at the end?
Yep.
Any other Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say, Scott, I was trying to remember the first time I had heard you doing the original version of this. And I have to say a couple of things. One is it's gotten much more sophisticated than it was when you were talking, this is 30 years ago probably, huh? When you were talking about sort of us going off the cliff. And so far we've been managed to avoid that, but like I say, this has gotten much more sophisticated, and the thinking in it has changed. At least it seems to me that it's changed. Maybe what my thinking that's sparked by it has changed. So I think one of us has gotten smarter over the term of this, and I wouldn't even hazard a guess as to which one.
Well, obviously you, because you've had to concentrate your brain power.
Well, there is that point.
But, yes, we do go back a long way. And I would just make two comments. One is that I said we've been lucky four times. When we started this, we had only been lucky once or twice. And we've had a lot of good luck in the intervening years. The other thing that's happened is that early on we thought, oh, Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, 10 billion barrels, that's it. And so we were looking at a 20 to 30 year lifetime for the oil industry in the state. And what we've discovered is that we've produced not 10 billion barrels of oil from the North Slope, but 16, and we're still going strong. And there's still lots of petroleum up on the North Slope. So we're looking not at a non-sustainable industry, which is what we characterize it as originally, but as an industry that can sustain the economy for many generations with some luck and good planning.
So anyway, thanks for hanging in there.
Yeah, well, thank you, too.
Just a quick question.
Well, I was just going to ask a quick question. It's unrelated to the previous question.
But go ahead. We'll get you there right there.
Okay, thank you. If you had to forecast the downward curve in terms of federal spending in Alaska, how would you forecast that curve down? Because it's definitely going down.
Well, you can clearly see that there are certain areas where Alaska's been has benefited in the past where we're having a harder time getting dollars. Things like the Denali Commission, clean water and sewer money. Historically, we get $100 million in grants from each of those through each of those programs, and that money is going down. We're looking more like at $60 million a year there. So there are a few programs like that where we can see the money going away. I think looking forward, two of the grant programs that are the biggest that we have to be try as hard as we can to keep our share going are highway funding and airport funding. Those are big, big contributors to the state capital budget every year. And, you know, particularly with the highway funding, that formula has been up for change for several years, and it's just been going on a continuing basis. But when it does get if the feds ever get around to redoing that program, it's something that we have to be very concerned with. The other big uncertainty is military spending, and I have no idea where that's going. But we've been very fortunate in the last few years; that's held up quite well. Oh, I guess I didn't totally answer your question, but it's not going to go away overnight because it's so complicated and so many factors to it. But it's certainly not going to grow the way that it has in the last decade.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along that same line, I know that a previous presentation that I've seen of yours did have state spending and tracking military funding coming into the state of Alaska, and I'm wondering, we get some glimpses at different times from the Department of Revenue and other departments of what I'll call the Stevens effect. And his presence no longer in D.C. to shepherd resources towards Alaska and the general conversation at a national level of no earmarks. Are you tracking that at all for the state in your presentations?
Well, not tracking it particularly closely. You mentioned earmarks, and of course, earmarks are really a small part of the total picture. We're talking about $8 to $9 billion a year in total. Federal dollars coming to the state. Now that's divided between grants that come through capital and operating grants that support the state budget, dollars to individual Social Security and retirement funds, the military spending, and then grants to nonprofits and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of ways that federal dollars get into the state, and earmarks is the one you hear about so often, but it's really not that big. I do try to track it, but boy, the federal reporting of the money that comes into the state is really lousy. It's lousy. That's all I can say about it.
Mr. Chairman.
But it's hard to follow that question.
I was wondering, I understand how difficult it is to track that money. Do we have any way to track Bureau of Indian Affairs and money going to tribal entities in the state to know whether that's going up or down at the same time that we're experiencing losses in other areas?
In theory, there is a way to track it, but, you know, the tracking is done back in Washington, D.C., and they don't know who we are.
Does that read or not?
Yeah.
Professor Goldsmith, the only other question I have is, as someone who's participated with you in the Fiscal Policy Subcommittee Working Group and the Subcommittee of the Subcommittee and the Executive Committee of the Subcommittee and the Subcommittee of the Fiscal Policy Working Group. Woo-hoo! After a year, I think I can finally track that. I wanted to publicly say thank you for participating in that. And what strikes me today in what you're trying to share with Alaskans is that we need to be smarter. That's what I've heard multiple times. And as we try to endeavor to do that as policymakers, do you have any advice for public engagement? We've been having a struggle, from my perspective, in all of those groups that I mentioned, in rallying support around a conversation that would engage Alaskans in, we need to be smarter and not wait until the price per barrel of oil goes down to $9 per barrel, or that production drops off further than is anticipated in the next 10 years. And so if you have any pearls of wisdom for us, we had a presentation to the full Fiscal Policy Committee from all of those groups that I said for recommendations, and are trying to move forward with what you're suggesting in a dialogue, but it is somewhat difficult if we can't get all bodies in this building aligned, per se, in delivering that message to the public. If we have people saying that everything is fine for the next decade and we don't have anything to worry about, it's difficult for the House to come forward and say, we need to save, we need to do X, Y, and Z to protect the next generation's future.
Well, I don't have any brilliant suggestions, but I would say that I've been really surprised at how everyone knows about the three-legged stool. I mean, raise your hand if you know about the three-legged stool. Yeah, everybody's heard of the three-legged stool. It's on the side of buses in Anchorage. It's everywhere. And I think one of the beauties of that message is it's a very simple message. And, you know, we're talking about fairly complicated things here. And the challenge, I think, is to make the message simple so that it can be conveyed in a couple of words and a little graphic. And I don't know what that would be. And then just pound that message home again and again.
Mr. Chairman, zero production times $250 per barrel equals taxes for Alaskans.
I'm just glad, it's unfortunate our colleague, Representative Wilson, wasn't able today. She was looking for the real simple, straightforward discussion. I think we had a pretty simple, straightforward discussion and presentation today. There were no real complicated graphs. It was pretty, it was about as understandable and straightforward and soberly blunt as it could be. So I appreciate that we were able to take advantage of your other travel here for the commemorative events and other work you're doing. So thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you for your patience.
So thank you for your patience, because you've been giving advice over a couple of decades. We are going to adjourn for today, and tomorrow we're going to meet the last time this week, we're going to meet at 8 a.m. And that's for a presentation from retired Admiral Barrick, current CEO of Alyeska Pipeline, talking about the physics, mechanics, and some of the blunt realities of operating a pipeline under conditions now and projections for the future. So maybe he'll bring some pins or something.
Economics wasn't hard enough. Now we got to get to physics.
I'm using that in the most general, basic terms here. Thank you, everybody, for the attention this week so far, and look forward to seeing everybody tomorrow morning at 8 a.m.